Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Grief in the Fourth Dimension by Jennifer Yu, narrated by Tim Lunabus and Rachel Wong. Part 1 and 2. Kenny. 1. Mom and Dad. My mother doesn't cry at my funeral. My father? Well, he's crying enough for the both of them. His eyes are red, his face swelling. He keeps taking his handkerchief out of his jacket pocket, wiping his face, and then refolding it, as if he's not about to need it again in 30 seconds. The crowd warbles its way through Amazing Grace, their voices echoing in unison off the walls of the half-empty community center, and neither of my parents sings a single note. At the front of the room is a casket. Surrounding the casket are two sticks of incense and a photograph of a boy, 10 years old, smiling up at the camera from behind a birthday cake. His lips are blue with frosting. The boy, of course, is me. Once, as research for a history paper, I spent half a day watching video footage from the funerals of various world leaders. Crowded, elaborate affairs with hours of speeches and processionals thronged with people. The videos always made me feel bad for their families, standing huddled together in the maelstrom of grief, surrounded by strangers all claiming a piece of the deceased as their own. It makes me grateful for the fact that the people here today are the people who matter, and not many more besides them. There's Iris, standing with Casey and Filippo, and the other Science Olympiad upperclassmen. Jenny, clustered together in the front row with the rest of his family, and a few of the teachers that I had been close with, looking unmoored and uncertain outside of the classroom. Afterward, at the reception, the attendees mill around my parents, radiating sympathy, saying things like, "Sorry for your loss," and "Please let us know if there's anything we can do," and "We brought a pasta. We hope that's all right." My mom always manages a small smile. Then she says, "So many times I lose count."
"Thank you. We really appreciate your support. Kenny would have been glad to know you came."
Sometimes my dad nods. Sometimes he reaches for his handkerchief. Sometimes he doesn't react at all. I want to tell him that everything is going to be okay, that he and my mom survived 32 years without me before I existed, and they can definitely survive another 32 years without me now that I'm gone. I want to tell him that there's going to come a time when he has to be strong for my mom, the way she's being strong for him right now, offering up their thanks to strangers, bringing condolences and casseroles like either could lessen their grief. I want to tell him that I'm sorry, but I guess it's a little late for that now.
2. The Room. The room has white walls and white floors and a high sloping ceiling lined with skylights. I think of the skylights as a potential escape route if the room contained a ladder or a table or any furniture at all. But there's nothing except for the 72-inch high-definition television recessed into one of the walls, the television currently playing my funeral. Whoever put this room together really should have included a chair, I think, and I've barely had the thought before there's a little pop and a wooden stool, real basic, materializes in front of me. On the stool is a small piece of paper that's been folded into a tent, like the name tags we used to make out of notebook paper in middle school. And on the piece of paper, in big blocky letters that look handwritten, are the words, "Any specifications?" Okay, cool. So I'm dead and I've gone crazy. I want a sofa, I think, because if I'm going to be dead and crazy and trapped here forever, I might as well be comfortable. And then there's another popping noise, and the stool turns into a sofa, centered perfectly in front of the television. The sofa is an enormous L-shaped sectional, with tapered wooden legs and dark blue upholstery. It's the kind of fancy that makes me think of the furniture catalogs my parents used to get in the mail when we were first opening the restaurant, which all had titles like Amsterdam Showroom and Antique Galleria, and were filled with prices several digits away from being something we could afford. It's the kind of fancy that makes me feel like I shouldn't even be looking at this sofa, much less sitting on it. I want something a little less pretentious, I think, because pretentious is the only word I can think of that makes expensive and classy sound like something you wouldn't want. Another pop. The piece of paper flutters to the floor, displaced by the transfiguration, and the enormous blue sectional is replaced with an equally enormous leather couch that looks ancient, with cracks running down the cushions and arms so worn that in places the leather is almost white. Not leather, I think. The sofa is reupholstered in black fabric. And maybe something smaller? The pop this time is louder, more insistent almost, like the room is getting annoyed with me. Now I'm looking at a plain black recliner. Big, puffy cushions, no frills. It reminds me of the recliners in Iris's living room, which her dad used to sit in every night while watching the evening news. Except a couple of months ago, one of their cats decided the recliner belonged to her, and it wasn't long before the entire thing was covered in a thick layer of cat hair that never seemed to go away, no matter how many times her dad tried to clean it. We used to call the cat Princess Moonlight because of the way she sat on that chair, like it was her throne, like the whole living room was her kingdom. I can feel the lump rising in my throat as I picture Princess Moonlight, as I picture Iris. I can't believe I made it all the way through the funeral, and now I'm going to lose my composure because of a cat sitting on a recliner, and then there's the loudest pop yet, and every inch of the chair is covered in a rash of tiny yellow smiley faces. "You've got to be kidding me," I say out loud. And then, pop, a piece of paper lands on my head. "Please don't be sad," it says. Then, almost immediately, there's another pop. This time, I look up in anticipation, which turns out to be a mistake. The note hits me in the face. When I unfold it, it says, "Please, life really isn't that serious." Another pop. Or death, for that matter. Pop. "Oh, well, who am I to say? I suppose everything is exactly as serious as you feel it is." Pop. I'm starting to think that this is how I'm actually going to die, because clearly the first time didn't take. Buried alive by hundreds of pounds of notebook paper, which, come to think of it, is not unlike how I lived. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to trivialize your feelings." Pop. "But I kind of like the recliner decorated this way, don't you?" Pop. "It's zany." "Where is all this coming from?" I say. I look up again, scanning the ceiling for a vent or chimney, but there's just the skylights and the haze beyond. Then I look around, scanning for what exactly? It's the same white floors, the same white walls, the same widescreen television. Though it seems someone has turned the TV off, because its screen is now black and lifeless. My gaze lands back where it started, the recliner. Its legion of smiley faces, the pile of notebook paper starting to form at its feet. Pop. "Please sit in the chair. It's comfortable like you wanted, and it's cheerful like you needed, and I sourced it from one of Yelp's most highly rated boutique furniture stores. Sometimes this specific recliner has a wait list several months long. We're lucky that the housing market has been in such a slump lately. The hoops I used to have to jump through to get a chair like this, you can't even imagine." I sit in the chair, because it's the normal, polite thing to do, and being normal and polite feels like my only available defense against the insanity of the situation. The recliner is, in fact, quite comfortable. "Thank you," I say out loud. I'm expecting another note, but instead, a heavy fleece blanket materializes on the left arm of the recliner.
Thanks again," I say.
I am, come to think of it, very tired, and I'm just about to close my eyes and try to go to sleep, maybe for good this time, should I be so lucky, when Caroline Davison appears out of thin air in front of me.
Caroline. 3. This is not how I thought I'd wake up this morning. Mrs. McMillan, my art teacher, always said that in order to paint a scene, you need to understand the scene. And to understand the scene, you need to see the scene. Not just look at it, but really see it. So, here's the scene. Empty room, weirdly rectangular. Maybe 25 by 50 feet? Though it's hard to get a sense of the scale because it's so empty. Vaulted ceiling with rows of skylights on both sides of the center beam, beyond which there's a wash of white, like the blurry film of slowly moving clouds. No other light sources or fixtures. White drywall, vinyl flooring. Big TV mounted onto one of the walls. Oh, and then there's Kenny Joe, lying in a recliner that's emblazoned with hundreds of tiny yellow smiley faces, underneath a blanket emblazoned with one very large yellow smiley face. Kenny is looking at me like he's the one who can't believe what he's seeing, which feels unfair, given, one, his choice of decor, and two, the fact that he's been dead since winter break. Kenny? I say. Kenny blinks, doesn't respond. I guess I can't blame him on the account of the number two of it all. Also, I figure that Kenny is a figment of my imagination, and I don't think we had interacted enough before his death for my imagination to be conjuring up realistic responses. I'm not even sure I remember what Kenny's voice sounded like. Mostly, I knew Kenny because he appeared in the school newspaper every couple of weeks for winning some regional science competition or another. And also because sometimes the softball team wound up at his parents' restaurant after games. Principal Myers did tell us everyone processes grief differently, I say. Though, this is oddly peaceful for a stress-induced fever dream.
That's what you think this is? Kenny says. His voice is deeper than I'd have guessed. A stress-induced fever dream. Either that or a really intense acid trip, I say, looking once more at the emoji chair. But I'm not really in that crowd, so I'm going to go with fever dream.
What's the last thing you remember? Kenny asks.
Well, yesterday I had softball practice, I say. A bit of a disaster, really. We started late because Becca was flirting with Tyler at the lockers after last period instead of changing into her uniform. And then we finished late because Coach Navarro made the whole team run extra laps as punishment. And then in the locker room after practice, Maddie got into it with Becca because she had plans to meet up with Logan before dinner to work on their AP history project together, which I'm pretty sure was code for, what about after practice? Kenny interrupts. I don't know. I must have gone home. What's the last thing you remember?
Kenny takes a long time to think before he responds, like he's surprised I've turned the question around on him. Eventually, he says,
I was in my room. I had just finished my math homework.
Oh, that's right, I say. On my way home, I called my parents to tell them I wasn't going to be home until after 6, so they could go ahead and start dinner without me. That got me a lecture, even though it wasn't remotely my fault practice ran late.
Did that have something to do with math homework? Kenny asks. There wasn't a lot of traffic on Route 9, so I figured there was a chance I'd actually make it home on time, and then they'd feel bad about giving me a hard time over the phone. But it was raining, and you know how drivers get when it's raining.
I don't, actually, Kenny says. I don't have my license. I was listening to this playlist Dom made me in an attempt to convince me that young Werther is the best musician of the 21st century, though, frankly, I think I am less convinced now than I was when he started. Have you heard his latest album? It's just noise. I mean, honestly. Anyway, by the time I got home, my parents... I frown. They must have been upset because I had missed grace, or maybe I managed to get home on time after all?
Caroline, Kenny says, and all of a sudden, he goes very, very still.
I go back to softball practice, to walking to the parking lot with Maddie, to getting into my car and turning the key in the ignition. I try to retrace my way home. Route 9,
A left on Hengrove, a right onto Walden. The road ends in a cul-de-sac, and we're in the brick house with the maple tree out front. 14.5 minutes from start to finish. A drive I've done hundreds, maybe thousands of times. "I don't think you got home on time," Kenny says, quietly. And then he slumps into the chair. And then, and I kid you not, the smiley face on his blanket turns upside down into a frown. "No, I don't think so either," I say. "I spent like 15 minutes stuck behind a Honda Odyssey." "That's not what I meant," Kenny says. "I don't think..." "Hengrove, Walden, Cottonwood Circle," I say. "So then I got home and my parents were like..." But I don't know what my parents were like. I can't remember. I give it another shot, this time with my brother. Cooper was probably a real jerk about it, I say, because he'll take any opportunity to show me up. I remember the week after he made varsity as a freshman. Insufferable. And last night. Kenny stands up out of his chair, looking panicked. His blanket falls to the floor. A bunch of scrap paper floats up into the air and then resettles, scattering around his feet. "I don't think you got home, Caroline," Kenny says. "Of course I got home," I say. But I'm back on Route 9 now, and this time I feel like I'm really remembering it. The steady patter of the rain, growing heavier and heavier. The steady pulse of the windshield wipers, drowning out Dom's playlist. Somewhere, distantly, the screech of tires. "There must have been an accident after Lake Street," I murmur. "You know how tricky that turn can be." My voice sounds distant, even to my own ears. I'm in the car. I'm squinting through the rain. I'm starving from practice, and I'm annoyed with whoever is driving this Honda Odyssey for going 20 miles per hour on a 45-mile-per-hour street. "I don't drive," Kenny mumbles. "It must have been bad," I say. "There were a lot of sirens." I trace the memory back one more time. This time, the Odyssey is washed in blue and red. The windshield wipers are still running, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, across my field of vision. I can see the wheel, but my hands aren't on it. I can hear the engine, but the car's not moving. Then, "Oh my God," I say, and it's hitting me now, really hitting me. "Oh my God, Kenny, I think I'm dead." Kenny sinks back down into his insane recliner and says, "Yes, Caroline." That was the conclusion I had come to as well. 4. Dom. When Dom steps into Principal Meyer's office, Mom, Dad, and Cooper are already there, huddled around the desks in the center of the room. I used to go there all the time to drop things off for Principal Meyer's from my mom. Cookies, dinner invitations, one time a bunch of old stuffed animals that she thought his dog might like. "What is this?" I say. I spin around, searching for some kind of explanation. But there's still just Kenny, reclining in his chair. "This can't be real." Part of me can't believe I'm seeing them. Part of me will do anything so I never have to take my eyes off them again. "Sometimes the TV shows us things," Kenny says. "What things?" I say. "I haven't figured that part out yet," Kenny says. "But..." I start, and then fall silent as Dom's voice cuts through the room. "What's going on?" Dom demands. "Where's Myers?" Dom doesn't have the same fond memories of the principal's office that I do. "Elliot just wanted to give us some privacy," my mom says. If this were any other situation on any other day, hearing my mom call Principal Myers Elliot would be by far the most bizarre thing happening right now. But it's not any other situation, and it's not any other day. And instead, the most bizarre thing is how my mom looks. How exhausted, how frazzled, how unlike herself.
My mom is the type of person who hosts the PTA's book club every month and always manages to procure tiny sandwiches and a fruit platter, even if they've switched the dates around at the last minute. She doesn't ever leave the house without putting on a high SPF moisturizer, and I don't think she even owns a pair of sweatpants. "Dominic," my dad says, "you might want to..." "Please don't tell me to sit down," Dom says. "No one ever gets good news after they sit down." That gets a laugh out of Cooper, though it doesn't sound very much like any other time I've heard my brother laugh. "Dom," my mother says, "there was an accident 2 nights ago. As Caroline was driving home from softball practice, she was running late, and it was raining." "Yeah, she texted me," Dom says. "After she finished practice. I mean, not while she was in the car. Caroline would never... She's one of the safest drivers I know. If there was an accident, if she's in trouble, it definitely wasn't her fault." Dom's always been like this, quick to the trigger, especially when people he cares about are involved. One time, word got out that Ian Miller called me a puck bunny, and Cooper and I had to talk Dom out of starting a physical fight. Those types of reactions weren't fair or healthy, I told him, and it was insulting that he didn't think I could take care of myself. But right now, his protectiveness makes me want to reach out through the screen and touch him. It makes me adore him so much that it hurts. "It wasn't her fault," Mom says. "But yes, Dominic, there was an accident. We don't know all the details yet, but there should be a police report soon." "A police report? Jesus Christ," Dom says, all one breath. "Is she in the hospital? Can I see her?" "She was taken to Bridgeport after the accident," my mom says. "But they transferred her to General Memorial last night because Bridgeport doesn't conduct..." She cuts off, pressing her lips together so tightly that they start to go white. She's not wearing a trace of lipstick, not even the tinted balm I got her for her birthday, which she always keeps in her purse. Next to her, Cooper is crying. I haven't seen Cooper cry since he was 8 years old. It's the kind of thing I would make fun of him for, if only I were around to make him feel better first. That's the sibling code, after all. You can tease each other all you want, but it has to come from a place of love. "Bridgeport doesn't conduct autopsies," my dad finishes. His voice is totally flat, like he can strip the words of their meaning by saying them like they have none. "So, Caroline is currently at the medical examiner's office. There will be a service next week. We wanted you to hear it from us, Dom," my dad says. "We know Caroline cared about you very much." Dom sits down. 5. 8, but none like that one. After the meeting, Dom goes to the hockey rink. He runs through a routine I've watched him do hundreds of times. Forward laps, backward laps, S-steps, hockey stops. 8 months ago, I wouldn't have been able to name a single one of these drills. Now I know which ones are done on the inside edge and which ones are done on the outside edge. I know Dom lets his weight fall to his heels when he turns too fast, and I can tell how winded he is by the shape of his stance. Between practices and scrimmages and games, I had always thought that I spent a lot of time at the softball field, but it was nowhere near the amount of time Dom spent at the rink. Sometimes he'd head there after last period and run through drills for hours instead of going home, for no reason other than to clear his head. Sometimes, on the weekends, he'd take his backpack and write his history papers or read English assignments while sitting in the stands, his class notes spread out on the bleachers around him. The rink was where he took me for our first date. It was where I found him after our first fight. It was where 4 weeks and 5 dates later, he said, "Caroline, I want this to be a real thing." And I said, "Isn't it?" Maddie and Becca had winced when I had told them we were official the next day, some combination of embarrassed at our cheesiness and disappointed in my taste in boys. "It's just," Maddie had said, "eventually, The whole good girl, bad boy thing never works out in real life the way it does in the movies. You know that, right? Becca had tried to kick her under the table and kicked me instead. "Ouch," I said, and Maddie must have taken it as a response to her comment, because she added, "I'm sorry, Caroline, everyone is saying it, but I'm your best friend, so I'm the one who's going to say it to your face." Personally, I thought calling Dom a bad boy was both, one, a stretch, and two, pretty generous. In the movies, bad boys were cool and charismatic. They wore leather jackets and always had impeccable hair, which was miraculous considering all the crazy debauchery they were supposedly getting up to in their free time. Dom, on the other hand, alternated between 5 t-shirts and pretty much lived in his letterman. He could be brusque, sure, and he wasn't one for small talk, but none of that was personal. "Army kid habits," he told me once. "No point making nice with people you aren't going to see again." But in a town like Winterton, where everyone knew everyone else, outsiders didn't generally get the benefit of the doubt, especially if they weren't making nice. When Dom asked me out, what I was supposed to say was, "Oh my God, wow, I'm flattered, but I'm just not interested in dating anyone right now." Something courteous and tasteful and girly enough to be sort of cute, but not so girly that it seemed ditzy, and something that definitely meant no. Instead, what I said was, "You want to take me on a date to the skating rink? Novak, do you have any idea how many ice skating dates I've been on?" "This'll be different," Dom said, and when I asked why, he smiled and said, "Because they can't skate the way I can." He was right. No one could skate like Dom could. I remember sitting down in the middle of the face-off circle after about 30 minutes on the ice had worn me out and just watching him do laps around the rink. Easy, effortless. I remember thinking that for once in my life, I could be anyone I wanted to be, and Dom wouldn't even know that I wasn't being the right person. "Skate the other way," I told him. "I'm getting dizzy." Dom did a few laps in the other direction, then skated over to center ice. "We can do something else," he said. "I made a couple of backup plans, so..." I stood up and kissed him. Then I lost my balance and brought both of us down to the ice. "You're leaning too far in on your ankles," he said. "A lot of beginners do it. You have to learn to trust your legs." "Shut up," I said. It was not the kind of thing you were supposed to say to a boy on a first date, but I said it, and then kept saying it. "Shut up, shut up, shut up." And he was laughing. But he did. Then there's a sudden burst of static on the TV screen, cutting through the reverie of the memory, ending the video feed. Dom is gone as quickly as he appeared. "Where'd he go?" I say. "Bring him back." And I don't mean for it to be a shout, but my desperation gets the best of me. "I don't control it, Caroline," Kenny says, helplessly. "The television has a mind of its own. Well, not literally, because we haven't even achieved preliminary robotic sentience, but..." Then, before Kenny can finish his sentence, the screen clears and the video resumes. Only, it's not Dom we're looking at anymore.
Kenny, 6. The television. In death, the stuff of life all starts to feel pretty insubstantial. I had always thought that I didn't own very many things. I rarely went to the mall. I never had pets. And we didn't travel enough for me to come back to Winterton every summer with piles of souvenirs from far-flung corners of Earth. But now that I'm watching Iris and Jenny comb through my bedroom, the detritus seems endless. Old notebooks, tournament medals, books I've forgotten I'd bought, and papers I've forgotten I'd written. Iris is wearing a black t-shirt and jeans, so distressed I can see most of her legs through the denim. Jen E is wearing a sweater that has become about 2 sizes too small over the last year, his shoulders straining the cotton. The two of them are arguing, just like old times. "This feels wrong," Iris says. "Kenny would have felt weird about us going through his stuff."
"His mom said he would have wanted us to put it to good use," Jen E says. "And besides, Kenny's not around anymore to feel weird about it."
I don't know why you have to say it like that, Iris says. Like...
Like what? Jianyi says.
Like it's something I don't already know.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?